Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Friday, May 28, 2010, I am delighted to welcome Jeremy Toman, founding partner of Stage 2 Consulting. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Yeah, welcome, and thank you for making time for the long holiday weekend. Everybody is kind of fading away, it seems like.
I know. It's going to be one of these days that by about 2 o'clock, I think, there'll be you'll see Foursquare up and Twitter down.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's a good assertion. Well, I wanted to start out by getting everyone acclimated with what you do at Stage 2, because it's unique.
Great. Yeah, we are a bit different than a lot of firms out there, in that I think most of the way we define ourselves is when a lot of the agencies and consultants define themselves by the vertical that they approach. So, for example, maybe it's PR, maybe it's user experience, maybe it's channel marketing, something like that. Our approach has been to focus on the horizontal perspective, and that horizontal for us is consumers and the way they use technology in their lives. So we call it consumer lifestyle technology. And for that, we apply a basic set of principles around user experience design, product strategy, messaging, positioning, go-to-market, social media, and then even PR strategies and execution programs around that. So it's a little out there, but yeah, we're having a lot of fun with it, I'll tell you that much.
Well, that's probably the most important thing. So when did you start the company?
So I started the company about 3.5 years ago. So my background, I've got about 13 years now in the kind of convergence space, that field that sits between, you know, the internet and consumer electronics and gadgets in general. Before this, I was at Sling Media, where I was the first employee there and responsible for taking the brilliance of the founders, their amazing vision, and trying to actually turn it into a product that we could ship and things like that. I had a great time there. And while there, the CEO, Blake Kerkorian, said, you know, I see a lot of things going on with blogs. I want you to just be on top of that and make sure we have a community and make sure these things are happening. And this is back in 2004. So as I said, the guy's a crazy visionary. And so today we call that social media marketing, but we were off and running with those programs, you know, literally 6 years ago now. And I left the company in late 2006 after it expanded to be about 150 people, and went off to start my own little consultancy here, helping companies with a lot of the principles that we had picked up along the way.
So how did you start your business? I mean, that's, I think, a question that lots of people ask. I'm actually involved in an SMB project right now, and so that's like the big question is, where do you start, right? So you have this cool concept, you've come from this visionary, you know, you've been from a company where you've been close to a visionary and been able to, you know, hopefully glean some of what led to Sling's success. So where did you start?
This is my second go at actually running a consultancy. I started my first one literally in college. And, you know, my advice to people on that is it's really all about having some particular type of skill set and knowing that there is a market for it. So back in the mid-90s, a lot of the work I was doing was actually user experience around early stage websites. This is long before Flash and JavaScript, but back in the, you know, 1.0 days of the internet, there were many people who did that, and I happened to be okay at it. Along the way, I've particularly focused in the consumer electronics, consumer media, convergence, television space, and you know, that now comprises user experience work, market strategies, understanding the technology, their implications, and this is an era where there's a lot of need. You know, you hear the phrase the consumerization of the enterprise. These days it's becoming, you know, everything out there is a consumer product in some way or another. So I left Sling recognizing that there was a bit of a void for both gadget firms, web firms, mobile firms to really understand, you know, how social media is going to be transforming their landscapes and how to properly design and strategize products to be in there. And so I basically, with a pregnant wife, quit my job and set my sails and see where they took me.
And I hopefully she was thrilled and supportive of that effort or that decision.
She was. We had an agreement based on it was actually based on how fast I would get a job offer from somebody. That was the agreement was if I could get a job offer fast enough, then she had enough confidence that things would be okay. And if I didn't, then I would go to the recruiters and have someone find me a job somewhere. This was back in 2006 when obviously the market was quite booming, so it was a good time for that. And then about 6 months after starting the firm, I pestered one of my oldest friends, Adam Berg, who I had worked with back in Pittsburgh 13 years ago. He and I had then worked together again at a company called Mediabolic, which got acquired by Macrovision a few years back. He had gone along with that acquisition, and I finally got him to not want to do the big company thing anymore and start fresh himself, and then he joined me, and now here we are. We're a team of nine and doing great stuff.
How many clients do you have?
Somewhere north of a dozen. But the work we do is really varying. We have some companies where we're really acting as strategic counsel, helping them analyze situations. So, today there's a bunch of rumors, for example, about the new Apple TV. So we're heads down putting together our brief and our strategy recommendations for a few of our clients as to what the impact of that could be, what should we do now, what should we do later, et cetera. So there's work that's kind of hit and run, and then there's other work that's very in-depth and very ongoing. We were able to time slice pretty well, and hence, what the team here is all for. We have a couple of people here who specialize in PR work, other people specialize in user experience work, and then a few others that work on the overall strategy, messaging, and positioning. And so we're able to be really effective at managing a lot of different type of work. And we always try to have that nice balance between feeling like we're working hard, but never feeling like, you can't possibly sleep at night because there's just too much on your plate. We're somewhere in between.
Oh, can I come work for you? I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding. But that's a very good, goal to have. Yeah, you want to make sure everybody's on top of stuff, but not so much that they're freaking out about it, I guess, is a good way of saying it. So talk to me about the consumerization of the enterprise, because I don't think a lot of people outside, certain arenas have heard that phrase. And
sure.
I tend not to use it because I think it can be kind of confusing to people because it hasn't really hit mass yet. So help me hit mass. Explain what you mean by that.
Sure thing. So I'm retweeting you right now, by the way. So what the consumerization of the enterprise is all about, is basically these days, especially as we have a younger generation entering the workforce and are actually in the workforce at big and small companies, the era of the, for lack of a better phrase, punch card style technology or DOS prompts or terminal views is completely over. People are used to the, quote, Web 2.0 look and feel of websites. So whether it's a reservation agent for an airline, a database processor for a large company, a sales person at whatever kind of company, they're really used now to web interfaces that are easy to use, where it's not about did you figure out the right keystroke, but simply did you click on the right link. There's that part of it, so that the products themselves, whether they are direct to consumer facing or merely for back-end operators, have gotten to the point where they are almost just like a consumer website, like a Facebook or Yahoo or virtually anything else. The second half of it. Half of it is the actual marketing of it, which is another interesting thing in that the amount of publications that focus on business and technology have really shifted their focus over the past, let's call it 6 years, to look at what is sexy and exciting and fun a lot less about what might even be, you know, real business numbers. We have a client that has 5 million users of their product, and I think their nearest competitor is less than 10% of that. But the client's not quite as sexy seeming to the industry. We announced the deal of them and a huge, huge provider in their space. People didn't really care that much. Whereas I think if we had announced that they had integrated Foursquare, you know, you would have seen it all buzz. And it's an interesting phenomenon to try to watch and manage and again, make the right recommendations for companies to deal with.
Yeah, I know a lot of the time when I'm talking with clients, we talk about the customers of customers in the B2B space.
Yeah.
And how,
yeah,
you know, this emphasis on social media, creating an immediacy and this perception of efficacy around timing that really makes companies have to be kind of consumer-focused no matter what, which I think is a great point that you make. And I think that it's an interesting place that you come from. I mean, I come from TV land myself. So talk to me more about how sort of the consumer side, especially entertainment in particular, is influencing your work now. Or if it is. Go ahead.
Right. Well, I was going to say, you go. You first.
Well, I was just going to, as an example, just because it's, to give you a place to start, I was thinking about, the kinds of research and metric data that television stations and media, with a capital M, is kind of collected forever, as opposed to, the kinds of things that just now some of the B2B clients that I work with, I'm telling them, we need to take a look at this. We need to be tracking for that as a best practice.
I'm not quite sure how I want to approach that. That's a big topic. where are you?
Well, talk about your experience. Of your Sling experience or any other media experience, how has the way that you tracked it or approached it, like, for example, demographic data or behavioral triggering, some of the things that are kind of key to some out there but not maybe as mainstream as some might argue it should be?
Sure. I think that's a great starting point. I think you have two different worlds kind of colliding. You have a world like the traditional TV and ad model where, frankly speaking, I think most of the people in that world would agree pretty quickly is that there's a lot of unknowns. You have Nielsen ratings, which have been, accepted, but I think always everybody kind of has always grumbled about, is this real? How many people does a box really represent, et cetera? Combined with the known current world distractions. In other words, TV, every time you read about the death of TV, it's obviously ridiculously exaggerated because TV viewing numbers are at an all-time high with the average house at over 8 hours a day of the TV being used.
Yep.
But what we also know is that at least half of that time, someone's sitting there with a laptop. So that world's become really, really funky to try to understand. Meanwhile, the ad world has been seeing the results of Google, where you know everything. You know that someone clicked on this link at this time of the day from this part of the world. We also know that between Google and Facebook, they know a heck of a lot more than they're not always talking about. But what it's giving these advertisers is unbelievably rich information. And at the end of the day, those ad dollars power both of our worlds, right? They power TV and they power the internet. If there were no advertising, there would be no more free. So we're seeing company after company try to figure out, which of the metrics that truly matter, what do they need to pay attention to, how do they get in front of those audiences, and how do they understand what's even happening with their audiences better, hence the whole social media monitoring side of the business that's obviously a big hot topic these days.
Yeah, I keep getting asked more and more about that by individual companies as opposed to agencies. What's your take on where social media monitoring tools are in terms of,
I think
sentiment ranking and that sort of thing?
I would guess we probably have similar opinions on this. You know, I think it's definitely on the early side. I think we're seeing companies doing interesting stuff. I think there's just so much FUD, and for anyone that FUD is fear, uncertainty, and doubt. There's so much, I was talking to a guy yesterday, and he said that in times of chaos emerge opportunities for immense profits. I know of companies that spend tens of thousands of dollars a month to simply monitor Twitter. And you see, to start to look at that and say, well, what are you actually getting for that, versus what you could get with a Bitly link? And you really start to question how these companies understand what they're doing. Personally, I think that there's a lot of there's become a lot of so much energy and noise and confusion around social media and social media ROI and social media monitoring that the firms have learned they can't just throw money at the problem. They've learned they have to monitor something and create an ROI out of it, but I think they don't yet know what they have to know. Right? We have companies like, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Sysimus, I believe. They do sentiment monitoring on Twitter. Seems really interesting. And I'm sure there's a lot of brands that can use it, but I'll often counter by saying, if you don't know that people do or don't like your product, paying for that service is just the beginning of the problem you have. So I think early stages, I think there's a lot of promising things out there. I think the most important things that companies need to do is really understand what to be monitoring. And again, the mantra that we have here is there is no one-size-fits-all solution to social media, marketing, monitoring, advertising, et cetera. I know a clothing brand that says that Facebook represents virtually all of their sales, and I know a gadget brand that will say that Facebook cannot sell a single unit. So simply getting up and saying, hey, you got to be on Facebook, is clearly the wrong statement.
Though, I'm sure you've had this happen too, where you come into a pitch, somebody's unhappy with who's ever represented them, and, they're a deep B2B player, and, their solution is so expensive that there's like 10 clients in the world. And you look at what a previous agency's done, and to give them a social media presence, quote unquote, and they have a Facebook page, which maybe, one thing you can say about that, among other things, is that it's clearly not a strategy. So,
absolutely, yeah.
One thing I wanted to touch on, I think that you would probably agree with this, is the role of strategy in all this, because I think you're hinting at that, and I think that's a very important point I would love to hear you talk about.
Absolutely. I think what people don't seem to get a lot of the time is that we've been here before, we've seen this before, we've done this before. Back when the web first showed up, the analogies and the looking at the history are so interesting, is that companies were told, hey, you got to have a website. And so out came the first round of the gold rush, which was people who knew HTML, and of which I was part, right? And then the next wave was your website had to do something. It had to be sort of interactive in some way. And maybe you had a survey or a game or a form,
polls,
or you could sell something.
Polls,
what's that?
Polls were huge.
Oh, yeah.
Before
polls
were
huge.
Everybody had to have a poll.
Yeah, and you had to have you had to have frames and tables and all this cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next wave hit where it said, okay, what are you doing with your website, right? Are you communicating? Are you selling products? Are you doing customer service? What exactly is the point of this whole thing? And then companies really started to develop much deeper strategies that said, okay, well, the web is our a new sales channel, right? Dell was a great example of a company that quickly realized that they could move their catalog business to the web. And that didn't really change their business, right? The web was simply another place to make catalogs, except it was free to print them.
Such a great example.
Yeah, and what's so amazing about that is that I saw maybe a few weeks ago, which means, of course, in our current era, ages ago. But I saw a few weeks ago there was this big thing analyzing how much Dell is selling computers off Twitter and how amazing that was. And I just kind of scratched my head and said, there's nothing new here. It's just another vehicle. To me, it would be more surprising that Dell wasn't selling computers via Twitter. And If they don't find a way to sell them via Facebook and via Foursquare and via anything else, they're in the we sell things business. So of course they're going to do it.
Well, and I think that, you know, we had Richard Benhammer on the show a while back, like I think in November. And, you know, I, at that time, a lot of people around me were asking, you know, is Dell Outlet and the success of it, is that that's a strategy. You know, that's a strategy. And I would argue that's not really a strategy. It's the right tool for the right, you know, for the right, you know, business, right? Because they never know what they're going to have. And printing a catalog or doing anything else traditional doesn't really make sense for an outlet, right? And so I said, you know, after a few people gave that example, I thought, oh, let's have Richard on. So I have Richard on, and, you know, I'm sure you know Richard. He's such a great guy and so down to earth. And he's just like, look, it wasn't strategic. It was just we don't know, and we can tell people in real time what we're going to have. You know, I mean, it's just literally, and he, you know, basically said the same thing, that it was the right tool for the right, you know, for the right need.
Yep. Yeah, I would say to anybody listening, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, fill out the, you know, MySpace, whatever it is, widget, JavaScript, apps, mobile, none of these are strategies. They're simply tools. It's about saying, you know, if you're a company X and you realize that there's a chance wherein mobile users need to do something and your technology solves that problem, then you want to address the strategy of how do they hear about you. Right, and your strategy includes building an app, and your strategy includes PR or influencer seeding, or maybe it includes huge banner ads on the side of buildings, or whatever that's going to be. But it's kind of that separation. It's almost a strategy and tactics, right? Or, you know, your tactic is outflank them on the war field. That's not your strategy. That's simply what the guy in the field goes and does.
So tell me how some of this works in practice for you. So, you know, I mean, part of it is obviously you're obviously consulting with brands, but you have a name of your own, right? And people know who you are. I think you spoke recently at the San Francisco American Marketing Association at an event for them. What do people, you know, when you do give talks, what are kind of the themes that people tend to ask you about?
I get asked generally in two arenas. One is as it specifically pertains to convergence. I've been involved in so many different products, gadgets, concepts, etc. You know, dating back to literally the year 2000 to today. So at shows like the Consumer Electronics, the CES. And I'm actually speaking in June at another CEA-related event. I get brought in to talk on that topic a lot just because I've seen so much of that world. I think the second half of where I get asked to speak is around marketing, product, and strategy and how they come together. You know, I'm a huge believer that the simplest strategy of all is great product. It is, you know, there's an old phrase that, which I guess was misused in political times recently, but the whole lipstick on the pig comment, you know, it's so apropos. you can do all the great marketing, you can have all this, you can have everything planned out to a T, you can do a great viral thing, you can do anything you want. If at the end of the day your product doesn't fulfill the expectations that have been set for it, it just doesn't matter.
It's such a good example because, you know, I know the people over at Nitro PDF and, you know, like, you know, and I have to disclose, you know, I, you know, have worked with them as a client and, you know, but they're an example where I would say, you know, putting their launch together, everybody was like not so sure and, you know, worried about all these factors. And then when it came time to, you know, watch the media hits roll in and, that's something else I'll ask you about in a second. But as it came time to watch media hits roll in, they got the 5-star review from CNET as, like, one of their first 3 hits. And, you know, it was like these are people that are trying every day to improve UI, to improve. So, you know, even if they're not doing it perfectly right now, not only do they want to hear what you have to say about it, but they're actually going to act on it. I mean, and that's like, I mean, it's so rare and it's sad, but it's really exciting when that happens. And it's like, I always want to call out companies that do those kinds of things. And if you have any companies you want to call out, feel free. But that was one of them recently where they had a launch this week, and I just couldn't, I think they're just fantastic.
And you think they're fantastic? Was that what,
yeah,
is that what
I
you
think
said?
Yeah,
oh, okay,
I think
cool.
It's fantastic that they not only have come up with a great product, but that they're listening for, you know, I mean, they were doing like an 11th hour installation of Get Satisfaction so that they would have this solution to hear from people, you know, and,
yep,
and take in their feedback. And, you know, I mean, it was just, it was like, it was the coolest thing, you know, and it's just the thing that makes it so cool in a way, and it's kind of sad, but it's just the reality is that that's where things are today, you know. Not a lot of companies are thinking that way, and so when you find one that is, like you said, I mean, it's like the power's in the product in the end, right? If you've got something good to work with, that's ultimately where everything starts.
Absolutely. I mean, this goes all, you know, ties all the way to the beginning of the conversation, is that consumers want stuff that they enjoy using. We come in time and time again, and our, you know, literally our first hour of meeting is just eye-opening for a lot of our clients. We've taken to recently, we actually will sit there and use their product and video ourselves using it and explaining what we're seeing and what they're doing wrong. And it's funny because, you know, we don't, it's one of those things, you make a half-hour video of yourself. You know, I don't want to, I don't mind, I actually enjoy the interview and et cetera, but I don't really watch myself all that often. And so when I hear from the clients that they, you know, not only do they watch it a few times, they dissect it, and it's like, wow, you know, this is really helpful, and it's so rewarding to hear. And we're just, I mean, so bullish on how much that you know, we call UBI, out-of-box experience, O-O-B-E, so how much that UBI is ultimately your sales point of your product. And you can tell the good from the bad in the first 30 seconds. You don't even need to go any further than that. And that's, I think, another thing that companies are only now starting to wake up and hear about. You hear a lot more. There's a lot more UX experts out there these days. I think there's a lot more that actually, a lot fewer than there are experts that actually show expertise personally. But it's one, there's such rarity in the field that you know, we need all the players we can get, for lack of a better phrase.
Absolutely, absolutely. So plug a product. Tell me about a product that, you know, you went in and it was like, this is going to be great, or it, you know, or maybe it's in process right now, but you just feel like it's an awesome solution. You know, it's meeting a need, because part of what you're talking about, which I think is really cool, is, you know, you're coming in with either a perspective or research on the market. And so you know kind of what consumers want and you know, where the movement is. And so you're really looking for, you know, you hope that the companies that, you know, ask you to come in and pitch are going to be, you know, catering to those needs. So, you know, give me an example. Plug somebody.
Trying to think who I want to plug. So, you know, as I pondered, I definitely want to volunteer one comment on it, is that I think the other thing that I'd love to get a message out to companies is, and especially, you know, product and engineering teams out there, is the basic understanding and acceptance of the concept that user experience is an actual talent. And not everybody has it, and that's okay. And I think, you know, the same way I'll make the joke in actually a lot of my pitches, like, you don't want me managing your books. You don't want me planning your taxes.
Yeah.
You know, you keep me away, trust me. But I can certainly make your product better. And that is what we go in with a lot of the time, because it's something I've spent so much time doing. Gretzky could put the puck in the net every time. There's a reason. He was naturally good at it, and he practiced. So if someone's most of the time job is simply writing specs, they're probably not going to be the guy who should be doing user experience work. So that's an often conflict I see, is that you might have engineering teams in the lead without taking human factors into account. I once heard Jeff Raskin, who was one of the fathers of the Macintosh, speak, and he just showed product after product and explaining these simple examples of how the team went wrong. And to be really clear on it, it's not, you know, I love working with engineers. I work with them all the time. And you know, it's that notion of separating skills. The designers can't code, right, for a reason. Right? We all that is the whole concept behind expertise. The example though in my head is that I really want to talk about is something we're working on with the company, and it's going to launch in a few weeks, and I can't really say what it is, so I'm going to skip the who. I'm going to not plug. I feel okay with that. But it's been a really fun ride because these guys are super open to feedback. They just want to make an absolutely great product. And these are what I was saying, you know, we sent the video to, and we've now, you know, literally dozens of videos. And the outcome, I mean, we're going to do a whole case study on the before and after, but the outcome is so drastically different. I mean, the setup process before was fairly rudimentary, required some technical knowledge. Not only that, used a lot of technical language, and this is a mainstream consumer product. And now the new version is just, I mean, it's just like clicking a wizard. It's like it's easier than downloading a plugin. It's awesome. And we're super excited to be doing it because we've really helped transform something into the vision that the founders had, and just great to work on it.
Yeah, those are always, you know, such rewarding experiences. So, you know, the other piece of this is sort of, you know, you're providing a unique offering. How do you, you know, getting back to the business side, how do people find you? Or is it a referral basis that most people come to you?
I would say 90%+ of our clients have found us through a direct referral. The rest literally heard about us through something exactly like this podcast. We spend a lot of time with we have a lot of friends who are venture capitalists in the Bay Area, and they help send us startups who, you know, might be three people in a room somewhere as a startup that really need a little extra help. You know, in a lot of cases, we're effectively an outsourced marketing department where we help on the product, we help with the strategy, we help on the positioning. We really create fill that whole void, which is a really fun relationship because, you know, for us, we try to be really picky about what we work on so that we can keep leveraging, you know, more and more exciting things. You know, we work with Bug Labs, we work with Boxy, we work with PogoFlug, we work with SpotUs, like all these cool companies all over the map. And, you know, I really look at it as kind of building a family. So it's been fun so far.
And I think, you know, the feedback from your team and the people that I've been lucky enough to know that have either been on your team or are still on your team is that you're a great guy to work for. So how do you build in that that sort of fun factor with still, you know, and still keep things, you know, serious enough that you're really focusing work? Because, I mean, your work is, you know, there are a lot of components to it, and you need to keep your eye on the prize.
I usually use a tactic around that involves threats of physical violence. I find it's mostly effective. you know, I'll give you an example. So we have an Xbox here at the office, and I'm the first guy to walk away from the desk and go find a couple of the people here and say, let's go play Call of Duty. That's our go-to game. And you know, every now and then a client will walk in while we're finishing up a game, and we all get this kind of confused look, like, am I paying you to play video games? And I'll tell you my philosophy is that there's no employee anywhere, at least, you know, outside of Foxconn, maybe, there's no employee anywhere who sits and does exactly their job all day long. People go to Facebook, people go take a personal call, people do whatever they're going to do, and that's fine. I think it's normal, it's healthy to think we are all, you know, automatons is just ridiculous. So if I know for a fact that I've got employees who are going to goof off at some point during the day, I'd rather embrace it and make it actual fun, not just kind of web surfing or, you know, playing another round of solitaire, but hey, let's go have fun for 20 minutes. And we do it as a team, and then people get back to work. And I'm sure they still go to their Facebook and all that, but I think it creates just a different kind of sense of, I don't want my guys working till 2 in the morning. You know, if there's a major deadline, then yeah, we go into crunch mode. And if there's not, then people, you know, in the winters, people go skiing in Tahoe and leave sometime early on a Friday. And I know they'll make up for the time because they're going to check emails over the weekend. And, you know, that's become part of work-life culture, that you're supposedly always checking emails these days. And, you know, I really want to keep it in a place where when you're off having fun, you're off having fun, and when you're working, you're working. I think that the future will be more muddied balance between those two things. So, you know, I'm doing my best to create an environment where, you know, when you work hard, and then you play hard. So,
yeah, this is sort of a Barbara Walters type of question, but I got to follow up. I hear a lot of people talk about work-life balance this way, especially women who've had kids. And I wonder if for you, because you're a dad, if that has made a difference in being able to say, let's, you know, really concentrate our time and do the best work and really kick butt and then have fun. Know when to sort of, you know, build in the structure so that you can have this nice ebb and flow.
Yes, having kids is definitely important for me for getting even more focused. I mean, let's call it 9 days out of 10, I will see my kids both in the morning and in the evening. And that's just super important to me. If I had to go take some boring desk job and phone it in just as my way of making sure I could keep that up, I would do it. Thankfully, I found a system where I can still do what I want. Every other Wednesday, I take my older son on the bus to the office. We stop at a little diner, and he plays in the office for half an hour. And there's still a mess on my floor, actually, as a result. And I don't care. And there's an old saying is I will never be sitting in my deathbed one day wishing there was that extra conference call I could have attended.
That's true.
You know, the parenting thing was a very big part of it. But actually, for me, it started a few years even before that. I don't remember exactly which job I was at, so I'm not pointing the finger at anyone specifically. But at one of my jobs, I was sent an email one night at 11 o'clock explaining a deliverable that I would need to have done by, I think, 9 in the morning. And thankfully, I didn't check my email that night. I checked in the morning, and basically with about 15 minutes to spare, informed that I would obviously not be getting that work done. And it was that moment where it got me really angry, because I felt it was just such an unfair situation for me to be in, that there was, A, the expectation that I just happened to check email that late, and, B, not given the chance to consult on what it would be as a deliverable, and then C, that the delivery time frame would obviously conflict with either personal or other work commitments. And, you know, to me, that was the ultimate setup for failure. So, you know, I try to be bucking the trend in a lot of ways. You know, I don't expect people to do email app for work in the evenings every day. When they have a deliverable, absolutely. When they don't, they shouldn't. That's my take on it.
Pretty cool. That's a very, very refreshing take on how to make a business succeed. So let's talk about the market research part, because I think that's, to me, you know, something very unique that we don't get to talk about a lot here, and is clearly kind of part of the, you know, for lack of a better phrase, secret sauce, right, of what is stage two, right? So talk to me about that. How do you actually conduct the research? Or what data do you look at?
Well, it's radically different based on the kind of work and client. But I will say this is, I keep my team focused on really understanding consumers as much as possible. So as an example, I encourage people, not necessarily on their weekends or whatever, but go to a Best Buy, just hang out for half an hour, watch people walking through the shelves, watch how they pick up things, watch how they look at boxes. I'm really a big believer in the hands-on side of the research. I think it's really easy to get numbers. I think anyone can get numbers, right? There's lots of firms that do great stuff. I think it's important to apply some common sense and logic to them. I remember at a company I was at a few years back where I got a research report telling me how big the market would be for a certain consumer electronics category, and we were the number one provider of technology in that category, and I knew how many licenses we had sold. And I called up the researcher and said, your numbers have an extra zero on them. This market's not that big. How'd you get it? Because you never even called us to see how we were doing. And, you know, I got to explain this muddy logic that talks about how they projected 10 years in the future and then pulled the numbers back from there. And I was like, well, I can tell you the numbers wrong, so if you want to know the real numbers, let me know. And there was no interest in that, of course. So, you know, my advice on using market research effectively is, one, get the numbers from the reputable firms and then apply a common sense math to them, because they will never be exactly right. The market will never be as big as you're told. And then B is go build your own set of common sense as to what space you're in. If you think people will use your mobile site while they're on the bus, make sure your employees take the bus. Know what your people are doing. Know what your target market is up to. And I think that, by the way, is another kind of the hidden half of market research is well-defined target markets.
Yes.
You know, men aged 18 to 34 who live in San Francisco is not a well-defined target market.
Yes,
you know, it's kind of a demographic. You know, you kind of know they'll like violent action movies, and that's about it. So the more, you know, I have this, and when I do some of these presentations, I have this slide of this guy. He's a Lakers fan wearing a Lakers jersey, Lakers hat. He's got a Lakers tattoo on his arm, and he's holding a Lakers puppet. And my standard is, if you want to sell something to a Lakers fan, this is what they look like, right? It's not about the demographic. It's here you go. This is a super detailed, defined personality. And the more companies do that, you know, the better.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's kind of what I was alluding to earlier when I was talking about, you know, broadcast background. I mean, for me, a lot of it is, you know, working with research departments and how numbers get crunched, obviously, sometimes, you know, on the side of, you know, making things look better than they really are, but nevertheless with the goal of getting the highest advertiser dollar. And, of course, that's become more and more complex. But I think, you know, the basic sense that you can crunch market numbers to mean anything you want, but how do you get really meaningful numbers if you want to do a good job and actually tell the truth?
Absolutely. That's a really, really great point. Another analogy I make is, as I'll often ask the audience, I'll say something, for example, you know, if you read about or see on CNN that 2,500 acres of Arizona are on fire, is that a big, you know, people will react, oh my goodness. And then the statement is, how big is 2,500 acres? And most people sit there and kind of shrug their shoulders because we don't have common sense parlance of how much that actually is. I personally still have no idea. You know, an area the size of San Francisco being on fire, well, I can make a mental image of that. Or an area the size of the entire state of Arizona, well, I can make a mental image of that. So, you know, today, and this will be outdated news by the time people are listening, but today, I think it was on Mashable, there was a post saying how Foursquare's got 1 million check-ins per day. So, you know, to some marketers, that's, oh, there's a million magic number, let's go do something. Well, I did a little number crunching, and I, again, applied some of that common sense logic. I went clicking around Foursquare randomly and just started tracking the ratio of check-ins per day of active users. And it seemed to be somewhere between 2 and 4, so I called it 3. Now, if I know that the average user is checking in 3 times a day, and they're getting 1 million check-ins a day, that they have about 300,000 active users. That's a much more important stat than the 1 million check-ins per day.
True.
Most, you know, that wasn't, that, by the way, what I just described was took me all of about 3 minutes. I'm sure I'm off by, you know, by my approximation, but probably not all that much. And now I have some data that I can go use usefully. So, again, it's kind of encouraging people to not just take the number they're given, but to see how it is specifically relevant and how they can actually make sense of it in their world. You know, if you know how big 2,500 acres is, you understand how big that fire really is. If you don't, go learn something else. So,
very cool. That makes total sense. And with just a minute to spare, I want to ask you, and we've got a minute overall, so a consumer trend that you predict.
For 2010, consumer trend that I predict.
I'm sorry, 2011. So you're coming up.
2011. I actually think 2011 is going to be one of the big years where we will see real change start to happen again in the living room. And obviously this is heavily biased because it's my field, but we haven't seen significant change since TiVo came out. Obviously over the years after, a lot more stuff happened. I think we're at the era where between Apple TV, Google TV, Boxy, and other companies, again, by the way, I've worked with Boxy, so it's not really a plug, but they're a major player in the space, obviously. Anyhow,
yes,
between those kind of guys, I think people will finally start saying, I want something a little different than a dumb box and a dumb remote. And I'm hoping we'll start seeing some of those numbers hit in 2011.
Well, Jeremy, I'm so glad that you didn't say 3D. Because, apparently this is the year of 3D, according to CES this year. But in any event, with little time to spare, I thank you so much for taking the time out on a day before the holiday weekend to join us on the show. Thank you so much, and let's stay in touch.
Thanks. It was a pleasure, a lot of fun, and I'll see you on Twitter, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. That was Jeremy Toman, founding partner of Stage 2 Consulting. And I want to thank you, the listener, for tuning into the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. If you like the show, we'd be delighted if you would friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio or rate us on iTunes. As always, you can keep in touch with the latest at jenniferlindsay.com. And have a great long weekend, and thank you to our men and women in uniform this Memorial Day.